The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, and it's as you were at the top of the Premier League. A nervy City beat Spurs for the second time in a week, but a win they can actually celebrate. Liverpool see off Cardiff to go back to the top again. Manchester United get absolutely smashed at Everton in the race for the top four that no one wants to grab hold of, as Arsenal lose at home to Crystal Palace and even let Christian Benteke score a goal. In the Championship, Leeds stutter at home while Bolton are down. Huge surprises in Europe as Juventus and PSG become league champions. Chelsea ladies get an away goal but lose in Lyon in the Champions League semi-final. We'll do all that, plus answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Good morning, Barry Glendenning.
Good morning, Max Rushton.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Is it getting to this stage of the season where we're seeing each other a bit too much?
Probably is, yes, and we're going to spend the next 72 hours in each other's company.
Do you want to have some quiet time? Will there be times for quiet time?
I'll be all right. Okay. I can look after myself.
Excellent news. Lars Siverton, hello.
Hi, Max.
You're not with us tomorrow night.
No,
you're not with us tonight in Glasgow. We get a day off, but we're with you tomorrow night.
Okay. That's good.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too.
Hey,
Joe.
Jonathan Wilson.
Hi.
Nice to see you.
You too.
Are you looking forward to our live show in Glasgow tonight?
I can't wait.
Excellent news. Well, before that, we'll talk about all the football, what happened at the weekend. So the title race then, Liverpool, 88 points from 35 games, City, 86 points from 34 games after they beat Spurs 1-0 in the early kickoff on Saturday. Jonathan, you wrote in yesterday's paper this was City showing their human side.
Yeah, I sort of think that the greatest sporting drama is when the people involved, the teams involved, are fallible. So I was saying that, and I realise this is perhaps something that people in their early 40s think, but the greatest sporting drama I've ever witnessed was Dennis Taylor beating Steve Davis in the 1985 World Snooker. Or, you know, Nick Faldo, the greatest of his three Open triumphs, was when he bottled it on the back nine in 1992, and then somehow pulled it back to... I mean, unfortunately,
Paul Azinger?
I think it was John Cook.
Okay.
In 1992. It's not even a famous man, which slightly devalues it. Was Azinger 87?
I forget.
Or maybe 90 held him off. But I mean, 90 won by five shots, I think. 87 was the 18 bars on the final day at Muirfield. This title race, you know, neither of the top two's dropped a point for 2 months, which is pretty infallible. But at least on Saturday, you saw City looking anxious, looking nervous. 10 minutes to go, they were leading 1-0, and the crowd are urging them to belt the ball forward, which is not what they do.
Did you feel the same, Barry? I felt that there were that nerves, and Spurs seemed to be able to get in behind City reasonably easily.
They did. They got in behind them on three different occasions in the first half, and at least another one occasion in the second. Ederson was forced to make several saves. At least one of them, a very good save. I think both sides could lay claim to, you know, having deserved a penalty, which neither got. And it was a very nervy performance from City, but the fact that they grounded out and won will give them, a huge amount of confidence. But I thought they were a little bit lucky, but they did show a huge amount of character because the tension was palpable from the stands. You could see the players were a little nervy. I think they were expecting to get that second goal that would enable them to, you know, job done, phew, and it never came, and they had to fight it out till the very end, and they did that, so fair play to them.
Who impressed you the most, Lars? Bernardo Silva had a good game, didn't he? He's up for Player of the Year, I think. And
yeah, he's remarkable, but I think Foden just looks... He looks... What?
The loudest coffee drink.
Oh, sorry. I didn't even know.
It sounded like you were sucking from the udder of a cow. It's mid-pod. Barry just turns to the nearest Frisian and has a suckle, and then we carry on. Lars, the point you were making...
I have squirted it in straight from the source, but never actually suckled.
How does that taste?
It's not very pleasant. It's too warm.
Is that right?
I don't like milk that is nice
cold. So ideally, if you are going to drink straight from the cow, put the cow in the fridge overnight.
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Lars?
Yeah, I thought Phil Foden was pretty good.
No, he did play well, Phil Foden, didn't he? And
it's something. It's it's quite remarkable for a kid his age to just sort of step into this team, this sort of well-oiled Pep Guardiola machine, which is one of the best. One of the best teams we've seen in the modern Premier League era, with these incredibly good players, and just not look out of place at all. I think that's remarkable. And in a game against another very good team in Tottenham, in this sort of really tight title race, as we mentioned, where no one's dropping any points, so the stakes are really high, and every single time you have the ball, the stakes are really high. And for an 18-year-old kid to just step into there and just look like he belongs, I think that's extraordinary.
It's interesting, because people sort of talk about Phil Foden like he's the greatest midfielder that's ever played, and this is almost the first full game he's ever played in his entire life.
He's got to be he's incredibly promising. What is interesting is, and I've made this point before, there's others as well have made the point that he should be playing more football. He should be going on loan somewhere, or he should pull a Jadon Sancho and head off to Germany or something. But then again, we're so we have a very strong outcome bias with these things. So if he just stays at City and keeps training with these guys and becoming integrated into the Pep Guardiola machine, when he does eventually start playing regularly, and if he does well, we'll all say, oh, it's very clever of him to not go anywhere, and oh, he's developed very well staying at the club. So I guess there's no right and wrong answer to that one.
Yeah, backing that up, he's the third youngest Premier League scorer for City. Do you know who the two players younger than him?
It was on Match of the Day, wasn't it?
Daniel Sturridge, and who did you say about? Micah Richards, yeah. So Daniel Sturridge, okay, I guess he had a decent career, the injuries hampered, but does anybody even know where Micah Richards is now?
I think he's still at Aston Villa, taking a very big wage and never playing. But he's been crippled with injuries. But the fuss around Phil Foden, the entirely justified so far by the looks of things fuss, reminds me when Joe Cole was an emerging talent. We kept hearing about how great this kid Joe Cole was. We never actually saw him play. And then he turned out, he was pretty good. But Kevin De Bruyne looks unlikely to play again this season, so that will presumably present an opportunity for Foden to perhaps be an integral part in a very crucial part of the season for a cup final and the league running.
And I mean, even if one might wish for him to have played more minutes this season, because he looks ready for it, for an 18-year-old attacking midfielder to be training with, you know, David Silva and Bernardo Silva and Kevin De Bruyne and stuff, like, it's probably not a bad environment for him to develop in under what is a fairly decent coach as well, you'd have to say.
Yeah, he'll probably. It's not.
Was there another noise there?
No, there was no other. What happened?
I just took a sip from my cup this time and was too cautious.
Oh, really? Have you
couldn't really enjoy it properly.
Why don't you take the lid off?
Good idea.
Yeah. Spurs, actually, I mean, because they got through the Champions League and results went their way this weekend, almost overlooks this actually terrible run that they're on in the Premier League. Two wins in their last eight, five defeats. They've lost their last five away from home in the league. Is the squad just too stretched now, or is this actually they're in a bet? They've come through that, and it was City away, and so they weren't expected to win and actually played quite well.
I think the squad is stretched, and I think that is causing problems. And obviously, Kane not being there is adding to that. The fact they're still in the Champions League means they're going to continue to be stretched. But given none of their challenges for top four are playing particularly well, and given that three of the last four games are at home, you would still think they're okay and they can focus on Champions League. I actually thought they played better on Saturday than they did on Wednesday. I think they were lucky on Wednesday, and on Saturday they...
It's fine margins, as Baz said on the last pod, wasn't it? You know, if Son scores that chance in the second minute, if he goes across the keeper, or Eriksen goes down, actually, when he's through.
Or just give a penalty anyway. Still a foul.
But you can't. I mean, we'll get on to Salah. They're never going... You know, we need referees to do that, don't we? And then Salah doesn't have to do his dive and Eriksen can get a shot away and they can still bring it back. City have three players up for Men's PFA Player of the Year. Aguero, Silva and Sterling. Bernardo Silva. Van Dijk, Hazard and Mane also on the list. Who are you giving it to?
I think Virgil van Dijk will probably win it. For me, it's a coin toss between him and Sterling. I'd probably go for Sterling. I think he just edges it maybe on stuff he's done off the field. I don't know whether that should be taken into consideration or not, but when it's the margin is that tight, I would go for him. But I probably Virgil will get it.
I guess the thing you'd say about Van Dijk is that he's probably more pivotal to his team. I think Sterling's been brilliant, but if you take Van Dijk out of this Liverpool team, I don't think they'd take as many points as they do, whereas City might. But if I had a ballot in front of me, I'd probably vote Sterling as well, yeah, just because of how everything's gone this year.
Yeah, I think I agree with both of you. Having said that, if everybody in the world, or everyone who followed the Premier League, wrote down their Premier League team of the year, you imagine Van Dijk would get in every single one.
Yeah.
Whereas there are more permutations higher up the field. I don't know when this, you know, there was a big hoo-ha that Son is not in this list, but then the vote's done in March. Presumably they should be able to get around
to... It turns out that Son's numbers, when you look at it, the bare statistics, assists provided, goals scored, they're not all that, even though he has been hugely influential. So while I wouldn't say, I'd have no problem with him being on the list, I can kind of see why he hasn't been.
I think the other sort of thing that counts against Son, and particularly in regards to what you're saying, that the ballot is done fairly early in the season, he missed two big chunks of a season to play in the Asian Cup and the Asian Games.
So it's players voting on players they played against, right? So
in theory, yeah. And I think that's probably why Hazard gets in when his form sort of dipped pretty badly over the last two or three months.
Can't they just... Surely they're all on... Footballers are all on WhatsApp, right? Can't they just vote it later?
Well, I mean, even if you're still using faxes, you could do it quicker than that. So, like, I mean, unless you're actually using kind of carrier pigeons or...
Ravens.
Or ravens. Please don't talk about that. I haven't seen it yet. Or, you know, just sending somebody on horseback. There's just no need for it to be that early. It makes no sense.
Yeah, I think so. Just to be clear, Barry, it's an early record and Barry got up at 5 to watch Game of Thrones. Jonathan hasn't seen it.
Even though I got up earlier than Barry because I had to work.
Bernardo Silva, Raheem Sterling also up for Young Player of the Year along with Marcus Rashford, David Brooks, Declan Rice and Trent Alexander-Arnold.
I mean, the fact that Sterling and Bernardo Silva are eligible in that category is ridiculous, no?
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a big hoo-ha over the absence of Aaron Wan-Bissaka, which seems entirely justified.
It just seems to... What's the point of the award? I mean, what's the point of individual awards? But what's the point of the Young Players Award when it features people in their mid-30s, however old these people are? I mean, am I eligible? I don't know.
Tom Finney.
it's not really the age is the point. It's the point that they've been regular, so they've seasoned pros at this point.
Once you've played, I don't know, 20, 30 games, whatever, you cease to be eligible for it.
City play United on Wednesday. United 6-1. To win a match at home. We'll get on to Manchester United in a second. Spurs play Brighton on Tuesday. Liverpool went back to the top yesterday, a 2-0 win at Cardiff. Liverpool statistician on Twitter is a guy called Jed Rea. Today saw Liverpool win a 27th league game of the season. Only once before have they won more in a single campaign. They won 30 in a 42-game season in 1978-79. 9 wins in a row in all competitions, 18 without defeat now. Yet they might not win the league, which is not fair, Barry, is it?
Well, that's how leagues work. It won't mean they're a bad team, but I would imagine their supporters will be utterly devastated. And as I said before, they could find themselves in a position where they win the Champions League and still look back with disappointment on this season, which is just a bit beggar's belief, but that's what could happen.
Well, that 11.7 millimetres at the Etihad could cost them the league, 100 points and an unbeaten season, which is a pretty costly centimetre and a tiny bit.
It is.
But I mean, when you say it's unfair, I know I bang on about this all the time, but people it's actually unfair on are the bottom half of the Premier League. The absolute nonsense of the financial structure of football at the minute, which I'm sure we'll come on to with European leagues as well. And what's the point?
It was a nervy game.
No, seriously, let's not pretend this season, in terms of Liverpool achievement, is anything like as good as 78-9.
No, that is a good point. It's easier to win these games now.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. But having said having said that, for two teams to have not dropped a point in 2 months is is still incredible, even if they should be winning.
No, it's incredibly engaging to watch as a neutral. Mm. It's incredibly, the level of football they're playing is amazing. They're not winning the games because the opponents are terrible, but they are winning them in part because they have such extraordinary advantages.
That's an interesting point, because it's easy to say, because we'll probably have the second and third highest points total in Premier League history this year, right? So it's easy to say, well, the opposition must be rubbish, but I don't think they are. I think if you go back 10, 15 years, the sort of the dregs of mid-table were worse teams. I mean, there were sort of random groups of journeymen who were very ordinary, whereas now, I mean, you see mid-table and even relegation battle teams who are signing players from abroad who would otherwise go to, like, Champions League contenders in other leagues.
But, I mean, again, the money shows this very clearly. I think Brighton are the 27th richest club in the world. Come on.
No, but that's... So we can talk about how the financial structure is distorted within the league, but the financial structure in the world of football is heavily distorted towards the Premier League in a sense that, well, is quite strange, no?
Yes. It's all terrible.
Well, is it all terrible? It's just different, right? It's just different. And so, however, you know, if it's coming from a terrible place, we're in a situation now, Jonathan, where we've got teams one and two absolutely fighting it out for the title. We've got teams 3 to 6 really fighting out for the top four. We've got actually got four teams really, really tightly contesting for the Everton Cup. The only thing
but
we don't
they're,
have...
They're, what, 15, 16 points behind
they are,
the team
but
in sixth?
True, but, you know, you don't...
That's a ridiculously large
but leagues,
chasm.
Leagues don't generally just go, there's 3 points difference between each side from 1 to 20. The only thing we don't have is a really great relegation dogfight. And I
well,
wonder
it's not if, that bad. I mean, Cardiff-Brighton is a
true.
Proper battle.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Okay, in that sense, it's okay. But, the absurdity of how much greater resources the top teams have than the bottom is shown in the stat I reproduce every single week, which is that there will be 60-odd games this season when one team has 70% possession or more. There were 63 last season. Between 2003-04 and 2005-06, in three seasons, there were three. So that's not even football. That's a lot of games now.
But it's just attack v defence, the training session.
One in six games. Yeah. Attack v defence. Now it may be that the modern fan, the new fan, the kids who follow a player rather than the team, people who aren't born in the area who don't have some family ties to the area, people who don't sort of have this slightly absurd visceral connection to their side, maybe they do just want to see people doing tricks.
Back to this game, if we can. It was nervy for Liverpool, and Sean Morrison had that. Sure, I mean,
very strange header.
What did he did someone
he closed
get...
his eyes? He's got to have closed his eyes, did which is how get... I head a football. Yeah. Close my eyes.
But you're not a professional footballer in the Premier League,
and
though.
You wear glasses.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't be wearing glasses if I was playing football, which is another reason why I wouldn't miss the header.
Would you look like Moley?
Because I wouldn't know which ball to head.
You'd look like Moley from The Wind in the Willows, wouldn't you? Oh, little eyes closed. Oh, so sweet, Barry. What's he done? Like, did anyone get a touch? Because I didn't see... They didn't replay it enough. Something
didn't
happened.
Didn't hit him sort of on the back of the neck or the shoulders?
I mean, you assume Alisson must have just brushed his gloves, but it wasn't obvious.
But, God, that's... I mean, a huge miss.
He scored 7 goals in the Championship last year. I mean...
And then he gave away the penalty, right? Which, on commentary, Gary Neville said, who was commentating in the UK, said it wasn't... He wasn't sure it was a penalty. I think he saw the replay again and then backtracked enough to say, actually, it was. But
I thought he spoke as a defender who used to do quite a lot of these things and quite liked the fact that it wasn't a penalty.
I thought he spoke as a United fan.
Possibly.
Did he... considering how much he had to say for himself yesterday while also not saying a lot, did he say, I will tell you next week whether I thought it was a penalty or not?
Or he'll give you the name of who's conceded the penalty, but we all know who it is. Well, we knew who it was. Can you, and I've asked this before, but can you book Salah for diving?
And give him a penalty?
Because that's what's happened.
I mean, yeah, I suppose theoretically you can, but it'd be an extraordinarily free-thinking referee who did it. I mean, it's a penalty, right? It is a penalty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That there's a little tug and then the arm goes around the neck. And among penalties Salah's won this season, I don't even think it's in the top three or four most controversial. But Salah has absolutely made certain the referee saw it.
But he has to, because he won't get the penalty if he doesn't. And I think, you know, I increasingly sympathise with the players who do this, because there is a clear foul there, but you will cost your team a goal if you stay on your feet. And, you know, until the referees sort that out, players will keep doing it, and I have a great degree of sympathy with them.
Baz, do you need to get off your high horse and put your drum down after Fabinho was concussed and was withdrawn from action?
Well, that's what should happen.
So you're remaining on your horse to bang it for other people?
Well, no, I don't like sit at bestride my horse, my high horse, banging a drum constantly, because that would get very annoying for everyone. But I will occasionally mount it, then I dismount, and, you know, as I see fit.
It would
also tire my horse out if I was constantly sitting on it, and give it tinnitus if I was constantly banging a drum in its ear. I suspect the horse would not take kindly to it.
It was a lovely finish from Wijnaldum. It was the Anderton Sheringham corner routine, and he struck it beautifully. And James Milner tucked away the penalty for the second. Adam says, do you think Liverpool will strengthen in the summer? If so, where? Jonathan?
I think they will, because most teams do. They probably want another centre-back. I think Mario Matip played really well yesterday, but you probably, if you're looking at where that squad may be short, you know, if they were to lose Van Dijk, that would be a massive problem for them.
Is it possible that Sadio Mane or Mo Salah will leave in the summer?
I doubt it.
I'd be really surprised. I mean, I don't think they may. I mean, I don't think any club has enormous amounts of money anymore. Real Madrid have clearly got some money, or Zidane wouldn't have gone back. But I don't think they've got the sort of 500 million you'd need to get two or three really massive players and to make one of them.
One team that might strengthen in the summer is Manchester United. They got absolutely annihilated by Everton, who did, Lars, play very well. They played very well at home to Arsenal. And you wonder, before we get on to the United discussion, which I imagine will be longer than the Everton discussion, I apologise to Everton fans for that. You look at those games, the Arsenal game and this game, and you think, Everton are good.
If you look at the name of the team sheet and you think Everton are good, I mean, right through the team, there are really good players there. They've been... I wonder why they've been so bad for certain parts of the season, but when it's coming good, like Bernard and Richarlison on the wings are very good. Gay is a very good sort of commanding, sort of kicking people in the legs type central midfielder. Schneiderlin is decent. Sigurdsson is brilliant. I believe outside of the top six now, only Jamie Vardy have scored more goals than Sigurdsson, I believe, this season, which is pretty extraordinary given that the season Everton's had has not been amazing. And they've got good, I mean, it's a really good team all around. They should be winning the Everton Cup with this sort of squad.
In this run of four home games against Liverpool, Chelsea, Arsenal and Manchester United, Everton have taken 10 points, scored 7 and conceded 0. I mean, it's remarkable.
It's very good. But then they lost to Fulham, which makes you question their mentality a little bit. I mean, when you got this sort of ability.
That's not the narrative I was looking for.
I know it wasn't. I'm just saying.
In 3.5 against Newcastle?
That's
not
awesome.
3.5, 3.5, sorry.
Yeah, not ideal. So, but this is the thing I wonder about. Like, it's clearly man for man a very, very capable squad. So I'm curious why they're not winning the Everton Cup and why they're not a little bit closer to the top four. But it is the first season under Silva, so maybe it's not uncommon that he needs a year to iron things out, I guess.
Am I right in thinking that until quite recently their record against teams in the top six was absolutely atrocious?
Yeah, it was around the time that I think Spurs put 6 past them, and then the stat was coming out that they just
it
hadn't.
Was just with monotonous predictability they would get beaten.
But then in fairness to them, they hadn't played very many of them at home this season. I mean, they've just played 4 in a row.
No, I think it was over years their record was.
Yeah, but I mean, you can't blame Silva for that, can you?
Tricky. Dominic Calvert-Lewin was brilliant yesterday.
He's played really well the last sort of month, 6 weeks, I think. Yeah, I thought he was. I thought he was very good against Arsenal. I thought he was excellent yesterday. I'm slightly surprised he's 22 now. In my head, he was slightly younger than that. But you know, he's looking like a player who's just sort of maturing. That all the raw talent we knew he had, he's now able to deploy.
He was up against Jones, Smalling, and Lindelof, who all spent a bit of time centre back. Does that make it easier?
I mean, we can go into United in a minute. I want to backtrack a bit. I came off sounding like I was a bit down on Everton after this game. I guess the reason I was down on them is I was kind of expecting them to be this good for more of the year. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff going on, and maybe we forget that they had this big. They hired a new sporting director last summer. They hired a new manager last summer, and we should maybe acknowledge that it might take some time for all of that to settle. But just judging by how they've been in the spring and in this game, they're a club that, well, could sort of be nipping at the heels of the top six next season.
Do you think they could, though? I mean, they could, but do you think they could?
I think it depends on what all the other top six teams do. I mean, if all of them are well run and make smart decisions, then because of the financial discrepancies, it'll be very hard for anyone to catch them. But I think all evidence suggests that they're not all well run and will not all make smart decisions.
But you certainly think Chelsea are vulnerable to a surge from part of that, you know, that Everton, Wolves, Leicester, Watford.
And United pack. Might be. Yeah, unless they make smart decisions.
Look at it, look at him turning on his countrymen.
Yeah.
no surprise, Quislings, a Norwegian word.
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer says, from the first whistle, everything went wrong. I just want to apologise to the fans. They're the only people with the badge on today who can hold their head high, because we can't. That was not worthy of a Manchester United team. Asked in a press conference whether his players care enough to play for United, he puffed his cheeks out and said, I don't know. 5 defeats in a row away from home in all competitions. We discussed the problems above management level last week. Lots of questions about the players, lots of questions about the manager. Now, Michael, when will Pochettino to United rumours start again? Ben, have Man United done a Di Matteo? Fred, how long before Ole is gone? They've got to stick with him. Was it you, Wilson, who said it was mad to appoint him permanently now?
Yeah.
And do you feel justified in saying
that? Well, I think the timing of a decision to give him the job full time was bizarre. I'm not saying he's the wrong man for the job. I think there were very, very positive signs in his first 2 months. I thought the way he managed the second game against PSG was, you know, he couldn't have done that any better. But I just don't know when you had the opportunity to gain 2 months more of evidence, you wouldn't take it. And the problem now is that sort of the credit you had in the bank has begun to be eroded, whereas if you'd wait till the end of the season, you'd seen where they were, you'd looked at the last 5 months in toto, then you could have made a proper and informed decision, whereas people are now always going to be going, oh, well, since he got the job, he's lost 4 out of 6. Whereas I was looking at your Solskjaer Tabellen. And yeah, you know, United are still third in that.
Yeah, which is the real quiz, as we know.
Craig Hunter tweeting, I wish I could be as happy as Mourinho is right now.
Well, the thing is, if United had played as badly yesterday, or as badly under Mourinho, which they often did, as they did yesterday, we'd be hammering him. So I suppose you can't absolve Ollie from any criticism, but he hasn't publicly dug out players. He hasn't been going around trying to start rows. And
well, he's also just very basic. He's had the job for 4 months, not 2.5 years.
Yeah.
So you accept that it might take time to detoxify.
But that performance was a disgrace, and there were players there who just weren't trying. You know, we all can have a bad day and get tonked, but you know, they thoroughly deserved to get it, and they weren't trying, and that's simply not good enough. You look through the squad, there's like, I don't know, 3 players here, I've just off the top of my head, that have been quite loyal servants but aren't good enough anymore. Young, Jones, Smalling, Rashford, Lukaku, Lingard. They are good enough, but they seem to be out of form. And then you've the likes of Pogba, Martial, Fred, Matic, all of whom you'd imagine might get drummed out the door. And
but why
David De Gea is having a mare as well at the moment, and he seems to have a bit of an attitude problem. There's relentless talks about a new deal for him. And
why would you try before Solskjaer got the job and now not try now he has got the job?
I don't know, is the simple answer.
Gary Neville said, I'm furious. There's some Japanese knotweed at the football club.
Very specific. Do you think he has a problem with his house?
It needs dealing with. That performance was rancid. I don't need to name names. They know who they are, and we know who they are.
That does make punditry easier.
Yeah.
If you have
that. You just don't have to name anybody. God, there was a team of the weekend, absolutely terrible. I won't tell you who it was, but they were awful.
Now, can I have my £1 million salary, please?
I'll tell you.
He might need another team. If he has Japanese knotweed. You know, there's a lot of expensive gardening to be done.
I really like it. I hope he does the rest of the season like this. Someone was excellent the other week. Goodbye.
Gary didn't name names yesterday, and I think we all have a fair idea who he's talking about, but. You know, he's still criticised.
Sorry, but we think Pogba and anybody else? Or?
Well, we know
Matic,
so
I reckon. Martial, I'm guessing. But, you know, he let it be known, I am criticising these people, but I'm not going to name them. There's an ownership at Manchester United who Gary never, ever, ever criticises. And I think they're hugely culpable in the current mess United find themselves in. But... Gary Neville never has a bad word to say about it. I cannot remember him ever saying a single bad word about the United ownership or owners.
Do you get rid of, for money, De Gea, Pogba, Lukaku, Martial?
So if you're a United fan, name a single player in that squad apart from Rashford, you'd be upset if they left, assuming you get a decent price for them.
Okay, so you get a decent price for them, and then you get rid of the ones who aren't good enough. Fred, Young, Jones, Smalling.
Fred might be good enough. I give Fred a pass.
All right,
there's enough in Fred to think you hadn't dropped him into this chaos, he might be all right.
So you got Fred and Rashford, right? That's not enough to start next season.
I'd keep Fred's Lindelof.
I mean, yeah, Lindelof I'd put in the Fred bracket.
They need some leaders there. There's no one. There's no leadership in that dressing room, or none that seems apparent to me anyway. You know, there's no Roy Keane figure, there's no Nemanja Vidic figure, and you know, maybe Rio to a lesser extent. I don't know if he was a leader, but you know, they need characters like that.
Yeah, but you can't, well, the point I'm trying to make is you can't get rid of 10 players and bring in 10.
Well, the Solskjaer did say that he wasn't expecting half a dozen to come in because he wouldn't want that much change. But he said that before the Everton game. I wonder if he might have spoken differently after it. The awkward thing is, when you're getting rid of people, you need to think of the Solskjaer song, "The All Is at the Wheel." Like, if you're going to get rid of, I mean, you'd think Sanchez, Pogba, and Fred, and also Rashford because he's born and bred, they would be safe. Or you need, at the very least, to sign someone who could put in that song and it'll still scan.
Right.
So Fred and Rashford, we've established, are good. Sanchez and Pogba, though, that's a bit more awkward.
Well, at least
you
just look for two syllables, whereas Fred, you'd need a.
Yeah, exactly.
I've completely forgotten about Sanchez. God almighty.
But so, I think Sanchez will turn out to have been the most costly, not just in financial terms, but the most costly transfer in the history of Manchester United because of what he's done to the wage structure. I suppose that is financial, but I meant not purely financial in terms of the fee plus his wages. What he's done to the rest of the. The structure there. You say you can't get rid of 10. You're right. You don't get rid of 10 in one swoop. But you acknowledge these are 10 of whom we're getting rid of these 5.
Yeah.
And we're planning to get rid of these 5. And I guess the 5 you keep are people like Martial, who
has just signed a contract.
You still you've just signed a contract, and whom you still have some hope for.
Sam says, how should Ole disclose those players who aren't in his plans next season? I was thinking an X Factor judges' houses reveal. Ole at a fjord with Des Irwin as his guest judge, casting off people, Smalling and Fred, one vote at a time. It's the Manchester Derby on Wednesday, and you look at it and you think, you never know with derbies, right? Form does go out of the window, but I think it's really got to go a long way to go out of this window.
It'll be interesting to see what reaction Solskjaer gets from Manchester United after that. You know, have they any pride? But even if they do up their game, I don't think they're good enough to beat Manchester City if Man City turn up.
You know. Yeah, I mean, it's this sort of magical thing of a reaction. They need a reaction. A reaction in this case meaning 10 new players, a new tactical structure, and a new mentality. I just feel sorry for Smalling and Jones. They're like, but like the lines outside the British Museum, they've been sort of patched together, and you quite admire them having been there so long. But they're not really there for defence anymore, are they?
Yeah, I see also Ashley Young. You know.
I mean, Ashley Young. I'm embarrassed to share a birthday with him now. He's just so bad.
But he's played. You know, he's been there what, a decade, in the best part of 10, and That's not his position.
Not his position, no. But still, I
think. And he's not getting any younger, you know.
There's something very cruel about the fullback position. I think when you go at fullback, when Gary Neville went, it's a real. Suddenly, you haven't got the pace, you haven't got the legs, and everything just disappears.
Dukla Praga Wakeit says, if Everton don't finish seventh, will the Everton Cup be renamed to whoever does? And will this happen every time someone else finishes there?
No.
Bit like the League Cup changing names every couple of years. No, absolutely not.
No.
It will always be the Everton Cup.
If Everton win it this year, it'll be their fifth win in 11.
Yeah.
And then we're saying they're looking good for it next year, so then they've won 6 out of 12. Every win at the year after, they get to keep it.
Right, that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll start at the Emirates, where Christian Benteke scored a goal. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Edward writes, if an Irishman, Scotsman and two Englishmen walk into a theatre in Glasgow after a warm, boost-filled bank holiday weekend, how does it end? Well, that's where we'll be tonight. It's going to be difficult. I'll be surprised if anyone hears us plug for this. I think there are about 10 tickets left. But if you are listening to this and you have 9 friends and it's 6 p.m. and you're in Glasgow, come along to.
If somebody's got 9 friends, they've got better things to do tonight.
SWG3 in Glasgow. Me, Baz, Wilson, and Ewan Murray. How many friends do you have, Jonathan?
Two? Okay, one.
All right. I was being surprised the other way. Do you want me to be your friend?
Well, not if it's out of sympathy.
It's a pity. It would be a pity friendship.
I've got a lot of acquaintances.
Okay.
Mm. You know, keep your friends close, keep your acquaintances slightly further away.
Tuesday night, we're at Elmwood Hall in Belfast. Me, Barry, Lars and Ewan with us again. Still a few tickets left. Come to that. The 10th of May, we're at Earth in Hackney. It's the four of us doing the live show. So that'll be nice. Come along. Right. Arsenal 2, Crystal Palace 3. I did not predict this, Barry.
No, neither did I. And I was surprised when I heard the result. But then Palace have been very good away from home this season. Even so, it's still a surprise result. And when I heard that Christian Benteke had scored himself a goal after almost a year without one, I nearly fell off my chair. But... I'm pleased for him.
He was in quite a lot of space, Lars.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's Benteke, but still, on a set piece, if they have a big man up there, maybe just not leave him completely alone, Arsenal defenders. That felt like a diss. That their approach to marking in general felt like a diss. And Benteke, you know, called him out on it.
Mustafi was trending. He was booked for diving.
Does that mean he's been killed in Game of Thrones?
Possibly. Will McGee say, Mustafi booked for diving to round off a 1 out of 10. A minus 1 out of 10 performance. He's defending from the second goal, for Zaha's goal. Sort of utterly bizarre. It was a flick on. Mustafi is in control there. He can, if he carries on running, the ball will hit him, right?
But presumably he was hoping to hold him off for Leno to come out and swoop, but it was ill-judged.
But I mean, that's sort of, I don't know. I mean, surely you have to get a shout. Surely your first job as a defender is to take a safety first option. And if you don't get the shout, you... Don't let a forward just run unchallenged into the box.
He looked like a lead-out man for a cycling sprinter, you know, the way he just peeled away and left Zaha with a clear route to goal.
I don't think Mustafi's first option as a defender is to take the safety first option in general. That doesn't seem to be what he does.
It must be so annoying for Arsenal because they were really good, I thought, against Napoli on Thursday.
Mm.
That was an incredibly sort of professional away performance in Europe. And then you produce a shambles like that.
And it's not just the Europa League curse either. Like, they've won the next game after the last couple of Europa League forays as well. So they've been able to do that Thursday weekend transition without, you know, being hobbled.
Do we have some sympathy for Emery in that he hasn't really been able to play his first choice back four at any point in the season? He played a three yesterday and he brought in Mavropanos. Jenkinson played, who's hardly played at all. Almost looking at the fixtures, thinking, our home record's so good, we could rest some players and sneak a win here and then, you know, save some legs for the other games. Ramsey obviously missing for this one as well.
Yeah, I think Emery's done a pretty good job this season. He hasn't had enormous resources. He's, you know, obviously coming in after somebody who's been there for 2 decades, so it's never an easy position. I think generally you'd say that There's more positives than negatives for Arsenal, but they do every now and again turn in totally shambolic performances like yesterday and like the defeat at Everton.
On Palace, a great win for them. Since recording the last pod, Roy Hodgson in his press conference came out and said that Wayne Hennessy was desperate to learn about the Nazis. Anyone's ever been desperate to learn about them.
I mean, they must be, because there's loads of books sold about it.
That is true. I think
Discovery Channel seems to... Yeah. Discovery or History Channel, yes, whichever
one. It's always either Shark Week or Nazi Week, isn't it?
Yeah, and I
prefer
Nazi
Shark...
megastructures and all that nonsense.
Nazi Shark Week is the one that they're missing, ooh, isn't it? As you mentioned, Wilson, Arsenal went to Naples 1-1-0, beating Napoli 3-0 on aggregate. They'll play Valencia in the semi-finals, who beat Villarreal 5-1 on aggregate. Lars, who are favourites for the Arsenal-Valencia game, would you say?
I do think Arsenal are favourites, mainly just because Valencia are having this weird season where they're fifth, they're right in Champions League qualifying contention, but they don't score a lot of goals. They've had 16 draws all season. Very, very strange things. Their top scorer is Dani Parejo, who scored 8 goals, and I think quite a few of them were penalties. So you'd think with the firepower Arsenal have up front, they should be able to best the frequently non-scoring Valencia.
Also in the Europa League, Chelsea played a balmy game against Slavia Prague. 3-0 up after 17 minutes, became 4-3 just after half-time. They've got Eintracht Frankfurt in the semis, who beat Benfica 2-0, taking the tie on away goals. Chelsea favourites for this one, Lars?
I mean, yes, but they're quite good. The Frankfurt. I mean, I'm not sure I'd make anyone clear favourites against Frankfurt at the moment, because they're a very good sort of swashbuckling side.
Back to the Premier League, Chelsea host Burnley tonight. Been a perfect weekend for them. Arsenal, Spurs and Man United all losing. They've all played 34 games. Spurs on 67, Arsenal 66, Chelsea 66, Manchester United 64. As Nestor Watch says, there can't have been an end to a season ever like this in England. Every chance of two All-England European finals, a relentless title race, four teams competing for third and fourth. It's the worst it's ever been, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, in terms of how good this is for English teams in Europe, which is a measure, I suppose, of how good a season's been, Chelsea and Arsenal winning on Thursday means that the Premier League's coefficient for this season is 20.701, I think. But anyway, whatever number it is, 20 point something, it is exactly what they finished last season on, with a minimum of 4 games to come and possibly as many as 6.
So what does that actually mean? The coefficient will go up, and what does that mean?
Well, okay, I mean, it could stick at 20.701 if
everyone goes
all
out.
4 English teams lose.
Okay.
Hang on, did I say 4 more games? 8 more games, sorry.
Okay.
Or it could go up to something like, I don't know, 25 and a bit.
But what does it mean to anyone if the coefficient goes up?
Well, it doesn't actually mean anything anymore, because the big four leagues in Europe are guaranteed 4 teams. But it means that England are closing the gap on Spain, I guess.
Right, okay.
But I mean, logically, England should be, just with the finances as we've discussed, something like, what is it, 6 out of the top 10 richest teams in the world are in the Premier League. So, I mean, it's only logical that they're dominating the European competitions. And the fact that we have now a solid top 6, of which 2 will always be in the Europa League, those 2 should really, you'd expect to see at least one of them in the final of that tournament every year, really, if they take it seriously.
Wolves 0, Brighton 0. Massive point for Brighton. In the two games between these teams this season, Wolves have had 47 shots with 12 on target. Brighton have had 12 shots with 1 on target. Brighton have taken 4 points from these two games. It's still 5 league games without a goal now for Brighton. 7 hours and 46 minutes. Matt Steele writes, "My son is 6 weeks old today, which means Brighton have not scored a league goal in his entire lifetime." Huge for Chris Hughton, that, Barry.
Huge. It wasn't pretty. Backs to the wall, parked the bus. Hugely unentertaining game, but a massive point for them. But, you know, let's not kid ourselves. They were very lucky to get away with it, because Wolves battered them and, you know, hit the woodwork on a couple of occasions. But Brighton fans won't care, and it's another point in the bank. Stuart James of this parish made an interesting point that, you know, he said he was cheering similar performances and results for Swansea last season, but with, you know, knowing now what he does, he'd rather watch them play better football in the Championship with you know, more entertaining stuff. But Brighton haven't been like that all season, but needs must, and it was a battling backs to the wall performance.
Steve Sidwell was on BT talking about how he's made a WhatsApp group chat with some of the senior players, telling them you've got to get the others over the line, kicking and screaming. I wonder if any of the senior players are replying to Steve Sidwell. It's just one of those WhatsApp, like my football team's WhatsApp group, where no one replies to me when I say who's around on Saturday. Also,
do you think they've all muted you?
Possibly. I don't know if Steve Sidwell's been muted. He also said the rumours about Houghton losing the dressing room are nonsense. He is a Brighton employee, so I guess he would say that.
Wolverhampton now, against teams from 15th and below, have dropped 20 points.
How do they learn how to break poor teams down at home?
I think they need to get better at playing in games where they have a lot of possession. So getting better with the ball, basically. I mean, they might need an addition or two in the summer.
They've got good players in there.
Yeah, they seem to be set up very much to play on the counter, they seem to be, and they seem more comfortable when they have space to run into, whereas when they're trying to break teams down, it doesn't work for them.
To be fair, they did break Brighton down on several occasions. They just couldn't score.
Newcastle 3, Southampton 1, a hat-trick for Jose Perez. First one was very well taken. Second, great determination and great centre-forward play for the third. Aiden says, could Perez make it one of the clubs higher up in the league than Newcastle?
Absolutely not. He's barely making it at Newcastle, to be honest.
Well, I mean, that was sort of what I thought, but he has played very regularly for five seasons now. He's played 35 games plus for five seasons, which suggests to me that he's absolutely at his level. Although he has scored a load more goals since Almiron came in. That front three, I think, with the two of them in Rondon, works really well. But, yeah, I mean, so I guess the point is he's now in a system that seems to get the best out of him. Why would you jeopardise that by thinking of a move? A
sensational foul on Almiron by James Ward-Prowse. It was a sort of great body check. Yellow card. I think everyone thinks it should have been a red.
No. I mean, it depends what you mean by that. Under the guidelines as they are, yellow is the right decision.
Okay.
Because the guidelines as they are say that, you know, if you're a long way from goal, and he was 69 metres from goal. However, I think it's ridiculous that only picks up a yellow card when it's utterly cynical, whereas you have things like the Harry Maguire red card, where the forward sort of just changes direction, runs in front of him, he clips his heel because he can't do anything, and that's a red. Yeah, I think the level of intent, the level of cynicism has to be taken into account.
That was 100% intent.
And Almiron is probably the quickest player on the pitch. He's going to cover that ground in 6-7 seconds. This isn't Frodo setting off for Mordor here and getting body checked by Ward-Prowse or Scott at the Antarctic just before he leaves the port on his great expedition.
And he had Perez breaking to his left, so all he's got to do is kick a ball into literally sort of, you know, a 40-yard square, and Perez is going to be onto it with nobody anywhere near him. So the professional foul law was introduced to stop people cynically stopping goal-scoring opportunities. That was a cynical stopping of a goal-scoring opportunity.
And I think James Ward-Prowse thought the red was coming, and I think he knew bloody he dodged
a
bullet.
The other thing with that, just putting your shoulder into a player running quickly is dangerous.
Yeah,
well, he hurt him.
He could have tripped him.
So, you know, it's a yellow for cynicism and a yellow for the violence of the danger inherent in the foul.
But to be fair, he's not that kind of player. So,
well, because he's got a double barrel name.
Hmm. Yeah. West Ham 2, Leicester 2. That was a good game, wasn't it? Harvey Barnes, first goal for Leicester. He's interesting because, Lars, he looks like a sort of League 2 centre-back or holding midfielder. But he's as skillful and talented as a skillful and talented young English Premier League player.
Yeah, it's nice to get the goal. I mean, after they recalled him, he's had a lot of games where he's run around a lot and gotten into a lot of good positions, and he's kind of made stuff happen, but the end product hasn't really been there, so I suppose that's very, very good for him. But Leicester in general, I think the Everton Cup will be very exciting next season, because there are quite a few teams in this sort of bracket. You know, Everton starting to look decent themselves. You know, Leicester after Rodgers came in looking very handy. You know, Wolves, of course, you'd invent their strength, and, you know, it'll be very competitive next season.
Plus Chelsea and United dropping down.
And this is the thing. I mean, if they're going to continue, well, Chelsea have that transfer ban issue and Sarri ball not really working. United have whatever's been going on there really since Ferguson left, so, you know, it could be very good.
It could, and Watford will be in it as well. They're in the mix for this one. The 1-2-1 at Huddersfield.
You know, UEFA are going to have this third tournament. Do you think we could have an Everton Cup Winners' Cup?
Oh, that would be glorious. Where, just with Everton. And with Everton versus whoever's won it.
Well, plus, you know, whatever the equivalent team from every country is. I mean, every team must have their side who's not really good enough to break into the elite, but is better than mediocrity.
Yeah. Oh, I would watch it. Well, I'd
say AC Milan.
Well, these days, yeah. Yeah.
Watford 1-2-1 at Huddersfield. Watford not in classic yellow. Three green kits played in the Premier League. Green kits should be banned. I mean, they look too much like the pitch. Even Plymouth and Yeovil. And anyone else who played? St Etienne playing green? Anyone else playing green?
Panathinaikos?
Yeah, get
Celtic.
Rid of it.
Oh, yes. Seattle Sounders.
I'm looking forward to seeing you all in Glasgow tonight. two for Delafeo. Could he go somewhere better in the summer? Could he? Is he above Everton level?
I just think he is where he ought to be, because he does great things occasionally, but he can just be maddeningly inconsistent. So I guess a sort of decent, aspiring mid-table team is a good place for him to be, no?
Bournemouth 0, Fulham 1. Stabilo tweeting, retweeted, I saw it by Archie Rintut, said, Fulham now essentially the loose horse at the Grand National, ruining everyone else's seasons. Their first away league win in exactly a year. Is this an issue for Eddie Howe? Like, realistically, if Bournemouth fade like this pretty much every season, and I think they have, does he have any right to be considered for the big jobs?
Possibly we should accept that certain managers are just right for certain clubs, and they should, their marriage should go on forever, rather than each partner constantly looking for a better alternative. But I don't think it matters when you get the points. If Bournemouth finish the season on 40, what are they on there? On 41 at the minute. If he finish the season on 44, 45 points, that's probably pretty much what they were aiming at the start of the season. It doesn't matter if they got most of them before Christmas. If there is a consistent pattern of them fading towards the end of the season, then maybe Eddie Howe can improve by looking at how he does fitness, how he does conditioning. Maybe the squad's not quite big enough. I think that data is how he can improve rather than necessarily being a massive criticism.
I mean, he has a better managerial pedigree than Ollie. But we'd all have been shocked if he got the Manchester United job.
Yeah.
There's no reason why he wouldn't be able to do it, but we won't know until he gets a job like that.
I think what this result, the question it raises more than anything, is what in God's name went on when Brighton lost 5-0 to this Bournemouth team, who seem to be so on the beach that they're this far away from actually like singing reggaeton and ordering drinks while the games are going on. Yet Brighton, who need points to survive, lost 5-0 against them. What?
In the Football League, at the top of the Championship, Norwich are limping over the line, a 2-2 draw at home to Sheffield Wednesday.
That was a good game, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Really enjoyed that.
You must search out Fernando Forestieri's absolute thunderbolt. Turns on it and bangs it top left from about 35 yards. Norwich equalised in the 7th minute of injury time.
That wasn't bad either.
That was a decent free kick, wasn't it? Two second half goals gave Sheffield United a win over 10-man Nottingham Forest. Lots of drama at Leeds. They're just, as I always thought with Bielsa's side, I've been watching this for years. I don't know if you've ever noticed it, Jonathan. They start to tire, don't they? Wigan had Cedric Kipre sent off a deliberate handball in the 14th minute. Leeds missed that penalty. They still went ahead 3 minutes later. Glorious touch and finish from grade 7 violin Patrick Bamford. However, Wigan's Gavin Massey had other ideas, scored twice. Leeds had 36 shots to Wigan's 8, but still lost 2-1.
I'm not sure this is physical tiredness. I think this is some sort of emotional... It might be emotional tiredness, but it's just that, you know, getting close to the line and tying up, isn't it? Which is, as we said earlier, it's the key to great sport if you're an outsider.
Yeah, Norwich, Stoke away today, Blackburn at home, Villa away, Sheffield United, Hull away today, Ipswich at home, Stoke away, Leeds, Brentford away, Villa at home, Ipswich away. So if we all think Norwich are going to take one of those places, because they got 5 points ahead of the other two, who's going up with them, Sheffield United or Leeds?
Sheffield United.
Lars?
Well, I'll just say Leeds then, just to be contrary. Yeah, it looks like it's all getting to them, but no, I still believe in the Bielsa thing. Come on.
Both.
Do it.
You think Norwich will crumble?
No.
Through the playoffs?
Yeah, why not?
Oh, okay.
I think they're both entirely deserving.
I think so.
Villa's, why not?
And I would like to see...
I'd fancy Villa massively in the playoff. Given
the only thing with Villa is have they gone slightly too early? You know, winning 9 in a row means they've got to win, another... I mean, say they've won the next 3 to the end of the season, then another 3 in the playoffs. Is an Aston Villa side really going to win 15 in a row?
Nine in a row is has equaled a record that goes back to 1910. Don't tell me about it, Jonathan. they are 6 points clear of seventh. They played a game more. West Brom, Villa and Middlesbrough make up the playoff positions. They all won. West Brom are 10 points clear of seventh, have played a game more. It looks like one of Middlesbrough, Bristol City and Derby will get the final playoff spot. Villa's win at Bolton means they're down. Rotherham in prime position to join them in Ipswich. In League One, Luton won at Accrington Stanley. The Accrington keeper had a great 22 minutes. He gave away a penalty, hilariously, miscontrolling a back pass and then absolutely nailing the striker.
That surely should be a red.
He got booked, saved the penalty, so he decided to give away another penalty, which he was also booked for. So then if we got sent off, Luton scored that pen, went on to win 3-0. Top four all won. Luton 90 points from 43, Barnsley 85 from 43, Sunderland and Portsmouth 83 from 42. Nervy time for your boys, Barry and Jonathan. Charlton and Doncaster look like they'll be in the playoffs. Peterborough could just make it, which would be incredibly disappointing for humanity.
Peterborough play Sunderland today, so hopefully we can put a nail in their coffin.
How weird are the Macums? Bradford are down, then it's tight. 3 from 8, really. Lincoln are up from League 2. It'll probably be 2 from Mansfield, MK Dons and Bury. Forest Green and Tranmere could still make it. Tranmere go to Lincoln today at the bottom. Huge goalless draw at home to Swindon for Colin Calderwood's Cambridge United. It means we are virtually safe. Pick 2 from Notts County, Yeovil and Macclesfield. Macclesfield 2 points ahead of the other two with 3 to play. Fitbar Mag says, would a 38-year-old coming out of retirement, Steven Gerrard, still be the best player in the Scottish Premiership, even if he was forced to play in his full suit and dress shoes?
It's a good question.
I mean, he wasn't the best player at LA Galaxy when he was there, so I would hope not for the sake of Scottish football.
Just after Thursday's pod, Scotland sacked Alex McLeish. I mean, literally minutes. It's the closest pod record finish and people leave the room and can't be called back to manager sacking that we've ever had. Are we surprised that he's gone?
I'm not surprised that he's gone, but Tam, the resident Scottish stereotype in my local pub, was absolutely outraged. He's very easily outraged, I'll give him that, but he was particularly outraged, not that McLeish had been sacked, but the manner in which he'd been sacked. Just that they'd waited so long since that embarrassment at the hands of Kazakhstan. I think people were expecting him to go, but it was shabby treatment. Why did they wait so long?
It's
I don't understand.
Like the Nations League means nothing. They won the agreement in the Nations League, didn't they?
No, they've got a very good chance.
Not very convincingly.
Wins a win's a win's a win.
True, but
especially if you're Scotland.
There's no obvious successor.
Your hands off Colin Calderwood
and Jack Ross. There's one really obvious successor, and I really hope he doesn't go.
Jack Ross.
Yeah.
My pub's resident stereotype thinks anyone would be mad to take that job because the Scottish FA seems to be run by, like many other national football administration, seems to be run by buffoons who have huge notions above their station. They still think they're back in the 70s when Scotland were something of a force in world football. And the way previous Scottish managers have been treated, you would certainly think twice about taking that job unless you were desperate for a gig.
Is there Fitbar?
Celtic were held to a goalless draw by Hibs at Easter Road, and Neil Lennon wasn't happy with their performance. Rangers beat Hearts 3-1. Jermaine Defoe, Ryan Jack and Nikola Katic got the goals. I suppose the big story of the week, Kilmarnock lost 1-0 against Aberdeen and had three players sent off, and Steve Clarke went on not so much a rant, but a controlled fury. He was very angry, very emotional, almost looked on the verge of tears after the game, complaining about the referee, Stephen McLean. And he got quite personal and said McLean is unable to handle Kilmarnock games properly because his dad, Stuart McLean, used to play for them and is in the club's Hall of Fame. And he said, people tell me historically that he has never been particularly kind to Kilmarnock. Now, the thing I'd say there is he's not supposed to be. He's a referee. But I think he maybe meant he overcompensates when he's reffing their games. And Clark said, I don't think he should be appointed to any more Kilmarnock games. I think that's a dangerous road to go down when managers are allowed pick and choose who referees their game.
True. And he'll probably get in trouble for that.
Oh, would prove to be a very expensive rant.
I can kind of see his point. If there's such a link, I don't want to question this guy's integrity, but I imagine, you know, it depends how you.
Well, the standard
your relationship with your father and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
The standard of refereeing in Scotland seems to be pretty bad at the best of times. But if you're a referee, you should be able to be completely impartial,
of course.
Link you have, however tenuous or strong that link may be. Mm. But whether he's got a point or not, I don't think Clark should come out and say that publicly.
I think that is also true. In the Women's Champions League, Chelsea lost 2-1 in Lyon. 2-0 down at half-time. Erin Cuthbert scored to reduce the deficit, bringing an away goal back to London next Sunday. In the other semi, Barcelona beat Bayern Munich 1-0 in Munich. That'll do for part two. In part three, we'll begin with Sid in Spain. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm marvellous, thanks. Top five all won. Barcelona staying 9 points ahead of Atletico. 5 games left now. Real beat Athletic Bilbao 3-0. Karim Benzema with his first hat-trick since 2015. Zidane called him the best number nine at the moment. 18-5 him. Sid, would you say Benzema is the biggest beneficiary of Zidane's return?
Yes, he is. Although I suppose the whole thing feels slightly empty. Because, of course, this is Real Madrid kind of going through the final 6, 7, 8 weeks of the season, knowing that they've got nothing to play for. And in a way, I'd almost turn that question on its head. Rather than Benzema being the beneficiary of it, he's the only one who seems to be caring that much. So he's not really benefiting. Well, he is benefiting in the sense that he's scoring a lot of goals. He's now scored Real Madrid's last 8 goals. Which is an absurd record. In fact, no one else has had a run that long of scoring consecutive Real Madrid goals without anyone else getting on the score sheet. But of course, it sort of doesn't mean anything. So it matters to Benzema in the sense that it's protected him in terms of the supposed revolution that's coming in the summer, which in the end, by the way, won't be a revolution. There isn't money to completely overhaul the entire team. But it's reinforced his position. It's given him a credibility that other players, in particular Gareth Bale, haven't got. It's made people perhaps appreciate him when they otherwise might not have done. But as I say, this run has happened once the season is more or less over. So rather than him benefiting from Real Madrid's run or benefiting from the return of Zidane, it's almost that Madrid is benefiting from him kind of caring when no one else seems to.
So you say there won't be a revolution. What do you think will happen then?
I think what will happen is they will sign. I mean, if I was writing down now a kind of a prototype of how I expect the summer to go, I would expect 4 signings, of which I would expect 1, maybe 2, to be quite big, and I would expect a couple of others to be reasonably important, but not huge ones. So they will try and get Hazard, and of course, given the contractual situation of Hazard, they've got a reasonable chance of doing so. I think they will try with Pogba, although I don't know if they'll succeed. I think they will buy a striker to play with Benzema, and this is part of why the Benzema run of form is important, because it gives him a little bit of protection in this. So I think it will be a striker to either be backup or play with Benzema rather than to replace him. And I think there will be another player signed somewhere else across the pitch. But I don't think we'll see this everybody out and everybody in thing. Not least because the reality is there isn't this absolutely gigantic pile of cash to be spent. They're going to have difficulties getting rid of some of the players they want to get rid of. And again, let's go back to Gareth Bale. I mean, you know, the solution to everything that's happening with Bale at the moment is for him to move on. But that's not that easy to do. You've also got a situation in which they've got quite a lot of players out on loan. And those players obviously automatically come back. So even right now, without buying anyone, you take one of his squad and you say, OK, first day back of pre-season, there could be 35 players in that squad. So it's not going to be that easy to manage. So I don't think this will be, because it's very, very difficult to do, I don't think this will be throw out absolutely everything and bring in a whole new team.
Getafe beat Sevilla 3-0, big game in the race for fourth place, and a sort of fun game in disciplinary terms, 6 yellows for Sevilla, 2 of them turning into a red for Escudero, and 2 penalties given out after VAR reviews.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. In a way, the 6 yellows are quite difficult to understand because it wasn't a particularly dirty game, which is kind of unusual in truth for a game between Getafe and a Joaquin Caparrós Sevilla side, because they're two very tough teams, Getafe in particular. but they only had three shots on target all game for Plata. But they're an incredibly resilient, intelligent, technically well-organised team. And right now, looking at the fixtures that are coming up, they've got a two-point lead in the that race for the final Champions League place. They've got Sevilla just behind them. They've got Valencia just behind them. But looking at the fixtures, probably just about. It's at their favourites.
Given the VAR there, we're towards the end of La Liga's first season with it. What do you make of how it's been implemented, how it's worked?
Yeah, I think this is quite, well, I say it's quite interesting. It may not be particularly interesting to you, but it feels interesting to me because I feel like over the last couple of Champions League rounds in which people are starting to see how VAR works, people in England are starting to see how VAR works, and some of these discussions about it, I've kind of watched and listened, and forgive me for using this term, watched and listened you lot talk about it. People in England talk about it and talk about the kind of the impact and whether they like it or not and the doubts that it creates. And it feels very familiar because, of course, this is what we've been going through since the start of the season. Now, it's curious, the whole thing. I must admit, to start the season, I felt, well, this is actually quite good. And on those rare occasions when I got the chance to sit down and watch a full Premier League game, at times it felt kind of a little bit anachronistic. But there would be just key decisions, you think, well, that would be sorted out very quickly with a VAR. And, of course, there's no VAR to go to. And it seemed a bit absurd, and it seemed kind of behind the times. And this is how I felt until around about January, February time. There was a very big decision in the Real Madrid-Real Sociedad game when Vinicius was taken down by the goalkeeper. And Real Madrid weren't given a penalty, and it wasn't reviewed by the VAR because they said the protocol. Now, this caused a huge stir. And at the time, I must admit, I thought the stir was massively over the top. I thought, well, look, just against Real Madrid, because obviously this is the nature of the media in Spain. Everyone's gone crazy about something that is, all right, a mistake and a bad decision, but not so awful. But what seemed to happen from then on is it seemed like the moments in which the VAR was used seemed to shift. It seemed to happen a bit more often. And I think I'm still broadly speaking in favour of it, but I'm starting to have kind of this sense that, yeah, but is it worth it? Is it worth that increased justice and, in some cases, on very borderline things, which wouldn't have been a huge scandal one way or the other, considering how long it's often taking, considering the lack of agility in making decisions, how long people have to wait, the way that impacts upon the experience of the game. And, you know, bear in mind, there's a big difference in watching at home and seeing all these replays and knowing what's happening and being in the stadium and just seeing the game stop and the referee standing there with his finger in his ear and having genuinely no idea what it is that might be about to happen. You know, teams celebrating goals and going, well, actually, maybe we shouldn't celebrate too much because we don't know what the decision's going to be. And it's lost a huge amount of spontaneity. Now, I know that's not the be-all and end-all, and I know in terms of huge, big decisions about justice and so on, of course it's right to have it. But I think a lot of things need to change in terms of the protocol, in terms of how it's applied and used. Obviously, I suppose the good thing from an English point of view is Spain has been a kind of a testing ground, if you like, not only Spain, but Spain has been a testing ground for this season. And some of those problems hopefully can be ironed out.
Sid, lovely to talk to you as always.
Pleasure.
Take it easy, Sid Lowe, out in Spain. I mean, what they need is a bit like in, you know, the baseball when the people who brush the diamond do the YMCA. During a VAR, they need the fourth official to...
do YMCA?
Yeah, or, you know, get the, all the, you know, and the referee's assistants. Some sort of synchronised dance. It's an entertainment business these days, isn't it? Let's get the latest on the Bundesliga title race with Archie Rintat.
Thanks, Max. A point still separates Bayern and Dortmund with four games to go now in the title race. Leaders Bayern staying out in front after a 1-0 home win against Werder Bremen. Unconvincing from Bayern, but 16 wins in their last 18 league games. Some fortune on their side, not in Milos Veljkovic's red card for Bremen in the second half, but that Niklas Zula's winning goal 15 minutes from time took a massive deflection off Davy Klaassen. So, Dortmund had to win at Freiburg on Sunday, where Bayern drew just a few weeks ago. And they did, 4-0. Jadon Sancho, 11th goal of the season, Marco Reus, Paco Alcácer and Mario Götze, the other scorers. Next week, Dortmund face Schalke in the Revier derby. Huge, because Schalke continue to endure the second worst season in their history, smashed 5-2 at home by Hoffenheim on Saturday, who in their final season under Julian Nagelsmann could be sneaking up for a Champions League place again, 2 points off current occupants Frankfurt, who are in fourth. Schalke, though, in 15th with 27 points from 30 games. As it stands, no danger of going down because the teams below them are so bad, but they could probably save their season among their fans anyway with a result next week in Dortmund. The fans will want revenge because going into this very fixture on the penultimate match day back in 2007, Schalke were top, but Dortmund beat them. Schalke, never German champions in the Bundesliga era, dropped to second and Stuttgart won the title. What about Stuttgart right now, though? 6 points below Schalke in the relegation playoff spot and smashed 6-0 by Augsburg on Saturday. Just under 4.5 hours after full-time on Saturday evening, Stuttgart confirmed coach Markus Feindsiel was fired after one win in 2019. Academy coach Nico Willisch takes charge until the end of the season. A quick word on Leipzig. Nearly got third place sewn up after a 2-1 win at Gladbach in fifth, but arrests made at the Borussia Park after a banner mocking the burnout Leipzig coach Ralf Rangnick once suffered with. On the pitch, very exciting right now in Germany. We'll tackle a bit of the second division promotion race next week, where Cologne are nearing promotion, but Hamburg, not quite.
Thank you, Archie. There, from Lukas Podolski's kebab shop in France, PSG could have sealed the title at second place Lille last weekend. They lost 5-1. They could have won it at Nantes in midweek. They lost 3-2. Instead, they won it before they'd even played, as Lille were held to a goalless draw in Toulouse. PSG celebrated by beating Monaco 3-1. Kylian Mbappe getting a hat-trick, bringing his tally up to 30 league goals for the season. Fourth, fifth and sixth all won to keep up the pressure on Lyon. In the final Champions League spot, they also won. Dijon and Caen both won. Guingamp drop to bottom after a defeat to Marseille. From one sewn-up title race to another, as Paolo gives us his Serie A roundup.
Well, you never believe it, guys, but Juventus have won Serie A. Yes, for the eighth season running, the old lady reigns over Italian football. They got there with 5 games to spare this time. Honestly, it was a bit underwhelming, as you'd expect. Juventus needed 1 point to get across the line at home to Fiorentina. They looked for a while like they weren't going to get it. They fell behind early on and then had Federico Chiesa, who they're probably going to try and buy in the summer, hit the woodwork either side of Alexandro's equaliser. But Juventus did eventually go on to win. It felt rather fitting in the end that the winner should come from an own goal rather than Juventus player. Cristiano Ronaldo, and like he was doing absolutely everything he could to get a goal. He was desperate for it because it would have been his 600th in club football, but he had to settle instead for delivering the cross that Germán Petzela deflected into his own net for Fiorentina. So everyone went through the motions of full time. Juan Cuadrado continued his tradition of covering everyone in shaving foam after a title win, and the public address in the stadium shouted Champions of Italy 8 times in case anyone had forgotten how many they've won in a row now. But the whole thing did definitely feel quite flat, and I think that's inevitable, both because of the disappointment of losing to Ajax in the Champions League just before, but frankly also just because Juventus are so used to winning the league now. It's become expected, and unlike last season, there was never really any credible challenge to them domestically this season. So there were some new landmarks in here. Ronaldo is the first player to win Serie A, the Premier League and La Liga. Max Allegri is now the manager with the second most Serie A titles after Giovanni Trapattoni. And Andrea Barzagli will retire now, leaving Giorgio Chiellini as the only remaining player who's been at Juventus throughout this winning run. So some things change, but the reality is that this is not only another year without that elusive Champions League win for Juventus, but it's also the first season since Allegri took over in which Juventus have failed to win a domestic double. So the chat in the post-game interviews was already very much turning on to what needed to be done differently next season. Still, better to be in Juventus' position celebrating an eighth straight title than that of the Champions League chasing pack. Roma drew with Inter, Milan drew with Parma, Lazio lost to a Chievo team that just got relegated a week before. So the final spot in the top four in Italy remains wide open, perhaps even to a team like Torino, who are hosting Milan next weekend.
Thanks, Paolo. One question to finish. Lord Kia says, may not be related to the topics in this pod, but which would the panel rather watch? A game of 11 Scott Browns versus 11 Lee Catamoles, or one of 11 Emil Heskeys versus 11 Shola Amiobis? There's an obvious winner there, isn't there?
I'll go Browns v Catamoles.
Yeah. Browns v Catamoles. The other thing just sounded like a really bad championship game with the ball bouncing around a lot and not much.
I think Catamoles would absolutely batter the Browns.
I'm rejecting the terms of the question.
Because?
Because Catamoles is just a good footballer.
Okay. Scott Brown's a good footballer.
Let me take you back. Yeah, if he's not as good as Catamol, let's not be silly about this.
Okay.
Catamol is, by some margin, the most misunderstood, most underrated footballer in the world. And has been for a decade.
Okay.
And let me take you back to 2012, I'd been at the Cup of Nations. On the way home, I went to Cameroon to do some research in my goalkeeper's book. And I was having dinner one night with Jean-Mangu Ongwene, the former two-time African Footballer of the Year. Would have played in 82, but he did his knee. Great Cameroonian midfielder. Mm-hmm. Now a football administrator. Very intelligent man. Obviously, understands his football, can talk about his football. Great politician. And I was around his house for dinner. And Jean-Paul Akono, the defender, turned up. And we're watching Sunderland versus Arsenal in the FA Cup, and Catmull gets booked in, I don't know, the second minute or something. And I'm thinking, oh dear, oh, it's going to end badly. And Catmull was brilliant for the next 90 minutes. Played in a very disciplined way, held his position, controlled the game. And these two legends of the Cameroonian game were sitting there going, oh, who is this Catmull? They were doing French accents, I have no idea why. They were pretending to be Philippe. This is Gadamuri. He's a great player. And I felt sad for the people of West Africa, for the people of Africa as a whole, for the people of the world, that they do not know automatically who Lee Catmull is. Because Lee Catmull is a great footballer.
Jonathan, thanks for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Lars.
That was really weird. Bye, Max.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
If you're coming to see us in Glasgow or Belfast, we look forward to seeing you. Barry, we especially would like to have a drink with each of you individually after the show. And we'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.